This episode of CPR's Connect the Dots is brought to you by the Center for Progressive Reform. Our podcast is supported in part by the College of Law and the College of Music and Media at Loyola University, New Orleans. By now, most people are aware of the tragedies in the western part of the United States, spurred by an insatiable season of wildfires this year. As of mid-October, unprecedented blazes have destroyed more than 4.1 million acres across the state of California, with firefighters facing up to 40 new blazes across the state on extreme days. Further north, in Oregon, wildfires ruined two cities, killed 23 people, and demolished 600 homes and 100 commercial buildings in the month of September alone. That same month, in Washington, a canyon fire torched 76,000 acres, shutting down a major highway, burning several homes to the ground, and causing hundreds of families to evacuate. A second inferno blazed 337,000 acres almost simultaneously. To date, there have been nearly 100 known wildfires in the West since April, and the scorecard is still in play. Just this month, in October, two wildfires broke out in Utah, burning more than 3,000 acres in less than a day, another 1,600 acres elsewhere in the state. Meanwhile, a fire arising in Boulder, Colorado, quickly spread to over 8,700 acres, adding more to the plate of firefighters who are already battling the biggest wildfire in the state's history. Now, this is not typical for October in Colorado, when normally winter weather moves in. We've lost homes, businesses, vineyards, redwood trees, livestock, fish. We've lost sisters, brothers, friends, parents. Smoke and exhaust continue to plague the air of our cities with plumes of dust, smog, and stench. Last month, I was with my family in western Washington as the California megafires were raging. On one week, the wind shifted north, and our skies up in Washington turned orange for days. Some days, you couldn't see the sun. Even the birds and the rabbits looked confused. Are wildfires a new phenomenon? No, of course not. They're as old as time. Are they inherently bad? Well, in fact, no, and we'll discuss that. They're necessary. The presence of wildfires in nature completes a critical component of the circle of life. That said, are wildfires advancing at a rate beyond our control? Yes. Oh my, yes. Wildfires are the latest cataclysm amplified by climate disruption, burning rapidly and haphazardly across the western part of this nation, along with other countries around the world. We're heading toward what looks like an environmental apocalypse. And unfortunately, many of us are in the line of fire.
That's kind of been the world I've entered into, spending 100 plus days out on the fire line a year. The fire seasons are getting longer, they're getting more hazardous, more properties destroyed, more homes, and more firefighters are dealing with injuries and at times death.
I was driving the other day and I was like, oh my gosh, it looks so different. And then I realized that I couldn't see the mountains because of the smoke.
The real disconnect between what we're seeing in terms of the pace of change and the level of the threats, and yet the lack of a political will and sense of urgency on the climate mitigation side, and the paralysis in our own political systems to deal with it, I think is really the biggest threat of all.
The truth is that we live in areas that are designed to burn.
You're listening to CPR's Connect the Dots, a podcast produced by the Center for Progressive Reform. This season, season four, we're examining the impact of climate disruption across the globe and how it's affecting you. I'm your host, Rob Virchik. On today's episode, a nation torched by fire, the factors that fuel the blaze, and the army of people working to put out the flames. So far this season, we've talked about how social castes and unfair policies have made certain communities vulnerable to the global climate crisis. We've talked about how those who are less equipped to defend themselves or advocate for their needs fare worse than others. But today, I want to look at a crisis that has caught the attention of almost everyone in the country, with disruptions that have crossed lines of color, class, and social status. In the West, few are safe from its wrath. That crisis is wildfire. It's hard to overlook the prevalence of wildfires in the country this year. Nearly every day, there's a headline in the news about another outbreak, the uncontrollable spread, and a dire need for resources to combat the flames. There's also the ongoing political volley, those on either side debating the cause and the best allocation of government funding. According to the current administration, the increasing frequency and impact of these blazes is just a matter of land management strategy. We need to tend the forests better. Rake out the forest floor, as the president once said. And there's some truth to that. Not so much raking, but other kinds of forest management. But I think you'll soon agree with me that the curious case of the wildfire is in fact one of the most explicit examples of climate disruption that we have on record. See, wildfires are a cycle of nature. They're crucial to maintaining forest ecosystems. We're supposed to have them. Yet it's our great fear of this natural event that has paradoxically led to its state of destruction. Before the 20th century, fire was considered productive, necessary, desirable. Indigenous communities used wildfires to clear out brush, a practice that's still done in some parts of the world today. Low surface fires sustained the terrain of the western United States by clearing out fallen debris from trees. Think about leaves, pine dust, branches. All that is known as understory. The understory is also referred to as surface fuel because it's easily ignited. Historically, fires were small. They didn't blaze through national parks and communities. However, once people became more fearful of fires and our ability to control them, things changed. Forest Service agencies began implementing new policies. They put out every fire as soon as possible. It sounds sensible, but this created a buildup of that understory, and the pile has grown deeper with time. Now, as temperatures soar and droughts run rampant across the West, we've created the perfect conditions to ignite an inferno. These days, not only do we have bigger wildfires, but we have more strains of them. That means different types and classifications. There are mass fires that expand for days on end, fire tornadoes spiraling tens of thousands of feet into the air at over 100 miles per hour, showering communities with burning debris, crown fires that envelop forests from the ground to the treetops, lightning fires setting areas ablaze merely from a harsh thunderstorm, megafires characterized by intensity, duration, and lack of control. And for the first time in modern history this August, a gigafire burning millions of acres of land across California. A family friend of mine, Sam Perkins, happens to be a firefighter. He's been actively battling these outbreaks in the West. Sam serves as a forestry technician and a smoke jumper for the U.S. Forest Service. He also travels around the world helping countries improve their policies. Needless to say, the past few months have been difficult.
As a smoke jumper, our primary purpose is to parachute into the fire area and provide initial attack services. But in this most recent fire, as it was involved in this large wind event, we had to step into roles in managing all the resources and strategy and tactics that were involved in dealing with the project fire, which are these fires that last days, weeks, months. On top of that, we were also dealing with a lot of the landowners, dealing with the evacuations, dealing with the law enforcement, and dealing with the cleanup, ultimately. Most recently, the first shift was 40 hours, followed by a 36-hour shift with no sleep, dealing with supervising aircraft or instructing aircraft, dealing with resident evacuations, dealing with heavy equipment and constructing hand line. As the fire activity became out of hand, it was stepping into those roles of, well, maybe we should reevaluate and come up with a better method of attack.
Sam followed in his father's and his uncle's footsteps. They're both firefighters too. and he joined the Forest Service after spending years traveling the West and falling in love with that terrain. Sam's father also worked in helicopter crews, something Sam found inspiring as a kid, though the challenges that he faces now are unquestionably more daunting.
Speaking from my experiences versus the experiences of, you know, my dad or folks that fought fire in the 1980s and 70s, you know, a big fire for him was 10 to 20,000 acres. And, you know, in the past few years, I've been on numerous fires that have been larger than 500,000 acres. I've been on a million acre fire. This most recent fire I was dealing with in central Idaho, just the wind event that would kind of rival the Santa Anas or Diablo winds in central and southern California, or contributed to fire growth that, you know, I hadn't dealt with in the past. A fire in our first shift grew from 100 acres to 14,000 acres, and most of that area that was being burned was going through communities. So dealing with the evacuations, dealing with the livestock, that was challenging. And just the amount of stress, the lack of rest. We've lost colleagues and peers to fires, and every year approximately 18 firefighters dies in the U.S.
According to Sam, this is business as usual. Let's also consider the fact that fire season has extended dramatically. Traditionally, wildfire season lasted 6 or 8 weeks, and budgets were proposed with that in mind. Now, the season stretches on for months, half the year even. Resources cannot account for that discrepancy.
As we've all noticed over the past decade, 30 years, there's been hotter and drier summers. More people are moving into fire-prone areas, and all this is compounded with perhaps mismanagement of public lands we've had in the U.S. And so over the past decade, an area of larger than the size of Oregon's burned in fires. Thousands of homes have been destroyed, and the occurrence of mega fires, which are fires 100,000 acres plus in size, are on the rise. You know, that's kind of been the world I've entered into. 100 plus days out on the fire line a year. Fire seasons are getting longer. They're getting more hazardous, more properties destroyed, more homes, and more firefighters are dealing with injuries and at times death.
Land management has been thrown around a lot lately as the primary cause of wildfires, notably by President Trump, who considers this the sole factor. And the truth be told, land management is part of the issue. So let's start there and see if we can unravel how we got to this state and understand why, as with other natural disasters, climate breakdown is amplifying the crisis. As I mentioned before, land management strategies have changed in the past century, leading to overgrowth and piling of debris in areas predisposed to fire. Without smaller, low-surface fires to clear out the brush, the land becomes cluttered with incendiary materials, the surface fuel we talked about. But there's also the matter of heat and drought, which are both strengthened by climate disruption. Trees and other vegetation are dying because their roots are competing for what minimal water reserves exist in the ground. A pest called bark beetles have infested tens of millions of acres of forest on the West Coast and in the Rocky Mountains. The Forest Service says climate change is increasing their damaging effects. According to Wired magazine, just 10 or 15 years down the road, tree mortality is expected to increase such that 150 million dead trees, or 95 million tons of firewood, will fall into this already dense pile of surface fuel and risk a firestorm across the entire western slope of the Sierra Nevada. That would be the biggest fire in history. Vicky Arroyo is a professor at Georgetown Law and the executive director of Georgetown Climate Center. She explained to me how climate breakdown is fueling the flames.
We're seeing a year-round fire season now in California, and then we're seeing these really dramatic, large fires that are, you know, really horrifying for those who are living through it. And I think that's not just because of the severe drought and the heat, but also from the insect damage that, of course, is also related to climate change, right? Because these insects can live longer and overwinter and do more damage. It is related to climate change, and along with the heat and the dry conditions, it's really creating tinderboxes that contributes to these wildfires that are burning millions of acres annually.
An extended fire season requires substantial resources in terms of funding and human capital to prevent and respond to outbreaks. According to CNN, since the early 1980s, the frequency of autumn days with extreme fire weather conditions has more than doubled in California. Rainfall during this season has dropped off by about 30%, and average temperatures have increased by more than 2 degrees Fahrenheit. These dry conditions, compounded with Diablo and Santa Ana winds, can lead to environmental incineration. Deadly fires have caused more than $50 billion in damage, in addition to draining budgets for the U.S. Forest Service and other agencies. The financial strain is something getting a lot of attention this past month, with Trump flip-flopping on his response to appeals for support. California Governor Gavin Newsom asked for financial aid from the federal government after wildfires caused infrastructure damage exceeding $229 million. The Trump administration initially rejected that request, then later reversed the decision. It's unclear what prompted the change of heart, though the president's general tendency is to make every matter an item of political fodder. Actually, in a campaign ad for Joe Biden, Miles Taylor, a former White House official who served in the Department of Homeland Security, said that Trump instructed his team to stop supporting such efforts because he was angry that people in California didn't support him enough. It wasn't his base. Well, regardless, it's clear that structures need to be reformed. Over the last few decades, the portion of the U.S. Forest Service's total budget dedicated to fire has grown from under 20% to more than 50%. As wildfires burn through larger and larger shares of the agency's budget, other critical services like habitat restoration, trail maintenance, even fire prevention strategies get put on hold. President Trump insists that climate change has little to do with the matter, a suggestion which scientists adamantly disagree with. Researchers at Stanford University, for instance, use climate model simulations archived by government research centers to demonstrate how human-caused global warming has made these increases in meteorological preconditions much more likely. Another study, done by the University of California at Merced, looked at how climate disruption influenced the jet stream, warming the Arctic and subsequently influencing extreme weather all over the world. They found that warming temperatures alter physics in the atmosphere, lessening the push and pull on the jet stream, which extends weather patterns like drought that contribute to fire conditions. In an interview with Fire Rescue One, Washington firefighter Deputy Chief Rich Elliott pointed out how drought has ancillary consequences too, depleting fire teams of water reserves to balance the fire season. These reserves generally accrue from rain and snow, neither of which has been falling much lately. According to Vicky Arroyo, there's no explanation but climate change.
We're seeing these really devastating fires in Australia and in California and, you know, pictures of floods around the world affecting so many millions of people. The real disconnect between what we're seeing in terms of the pace of change and the level of the threats and yet the lack of a political will and sense of urgency on the climate mitigation side and the paralysis in our own political systems to deal with it, I think is really the biggest threat of all. You know, that's not to say that there's not choices that people are making in terms of land management that would make a difference, but also, you know, how close we are situating through our land use policies and laws, urban areas and building of homes and businesses and the wildlands without buffers. That's something that I think we really need to take a look at. But clearly climate change is really driving the kind of, you know, mega fires that we're seeing, the firestorms that we're seeing out west and in other parts of the world.
Now that the Trump administration has agreed to offer assistance by declaring a major disaster in California, where will that money go exactly? According to Vox News, California residents most susceptible to fires are eligible now for federal aid, including grants for temporary housing and home repairs, low-cost loans to cover uninsured property losses, and other programs to help with their recovery. The declaration also frees up federal funding for hazard mitigation measures. So there will be some clearing out of brush and fallen trees, but primarily money will be put towards rebuilding infrastructure and lost homes. Which brings us to yet another side of the problem. We're situating ourselves right in the path of combustion. Or to put it another way, we're expanding the wildfire bullseye. Over the past few decades, substantial infrastructure has been placed in areas prone to fire. In the advent of a spark, what may have once done minor damage now wreaks havoc on homesteads and office space. Traditional wildfires are meant to clear out the forest, not the shopping malls. But we want what we want. I would be hard-pressed to find anyone who doesn't appreciate the view of the mountains and the pines from their back porch, the scent of fresh rain or age-old timber breezing through their windows. Again, here's Vicky Arroyo.
Developers and realtors and the public, you know, who want their homes in a certain place that's scenic and they're attracted there because of the trees and the beauty, don't necessarily want to be told that they can't live where they want to live or they can't build a really large house or that they need to cut down those trees that made that house attractive to them. So I think it's like the pressures of, you know, development and, you know, the tax base and the value of individual property rights that we see, you know, bumping up against a lot of environmental or other regulation.
Such individualism or lust for what we feel is rightfully ours, it has detrimental effects on the land and those protecting it. Firefighter Sam Perkins suggests it's nearly unmanageable.
The truth is that we live in areas that are designed to burn. Over two-thirds of new addresses in the U.S. are in fire-prone areas. Across the American West, between 1 in 10 and 1 in 5 residences are located in the wildland-urban interface, which are areas where homes and forested areas intersect. The management strategy, ultimately the strategy of the Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management, is to protect life and property. And so it becomes really challenging to manage hazard, manage risk in the fall and the spring through use of prescribed fire or vegetation management when a lot of the budget's allocated towards or the serious fire months of August and September of these million-billion-dollar fires that we have to deal with.
Not only are we living in these tinderboxes, our proximity to surface fuels and other fire-sensitive materials leads to easy ignition. Remember the notorious gender reveal party in September? A family used some sort of pyrotechnic device to surprise guests at their backyard get-together, and they set off a wildfire that consumed over 20,000 acres in California, leading to the death of a firefighter. When we live in homes surrounded by forests and subject to hot, dry conditions, any slip-up can prove disastrous.
For a wildfire to occur, there has to be a lot of factors that line up, whether that's temperature, humidity, periods of drought, the ignition sources, extreme weather. Today, there's just quite a few more conditions that allow all these contributors to wildfires to occur. About 90% of fires are caused by humans. That could be from unattended campfires. It can be from car accidents or any source of a spark.
By now, we've all seen the smoky photos on the news or in our social media feeds. Orange skies, bloated with dusty canopies of smog, like ugly tarps, blocking the sun during what normally would have been its daytime shine. We've seen mountains ablaze, families evacuating. Sometimes we can't see anything at all. The effects of these megafires extend far and beyond where they initiate, and there are health consequences too. Cynthia Moore is a longtime resident of Las Vegas, which happens to be where I was born and raised. She's also a mother, a consultant for the Moms Clean Air Force, and a longtime environmental activist. Like most cities in the United States, Las Vegas has gotten hotter in recent years, and the lack of rainfall is more than apparent. Cynthia and I both grew up swimming and hiking around Lake Mead. It's a beautiful water landscape just outside the city. It's a joyous activity she worries her son won't similarly have the chance to enjoy.
I went to Lake Mead a few months ago because I was trying to do something fun with my son because of the pandemic. I was surprised to see the water levels are just extremely low. Back then, the water levels were low too, but now it's just even worse. I saw a news article not too long ago that talked about how Las Vegas doesn't really have much more water supply left. We only have enough to get us till 2050. But if we continue to grow, our demand for water is going to increase. So that's going to really cut down on the amount of water that we're going to have available. I believe that generating electricity is the number one usage of water in Nevada. The more houses we have on the grid and the more people that continue to move in, it'll increase our demand for water. It really has me worried because at this point, I don't really think I'm going to be able to share my experiences that I had at Lake Mead with my son.
To give you a little context, I'll tell you about my own experience. So back in the early 80s, when I was in high school, we used to go to a place called the Cliffs at Lake Mead, and we would get right to the edge and then jump off into the water. The last time I visited Lake Mead just a few years ago, if you jumped off the cliffs, you'd hit the rocks. The water had completely dried up. It was devastating. This year, the city went over 150 days without any measurable rain. And while Cynthia may not be subject to wildfires like those in California, she's certainly bearing the burden of their exhaust. Winds are carrying the smoke across state lines, and that soot is mixing with all other kinds of air pollutants in the Las Vegas Valley.
You know, my son is so young. I feel like he's missing out a lot on his childhood. I mean, he's only three, but I feel like he's already missing out on a lot of things because during the summer months, I don't let him play outside because of the heat. And then the other issue is also our air quality in Las Vegas. It's just so bad. The American Lung Association recently ranked us for the state of the air report that they released a few months ago. They ranked us number 9 in the entire country for ground level ozone pollution. And last year we were number 13. So in just 1 year, we jumped 4 spaces. And then now we have the wildfires and the smoke that's blowing over from California. I was driving the other day and I was like, oh my gosh, it looks so different. And then I realized that I couldn't see the mountains because of the smoke. And normally, you know, when you're driving around Las Vegas, you see mountains everywhere because we're a valley.
Sometimes, even on a nice day, Cynthia can't take her son out to play.
We had nice weather a few weeks ago, and I thought about taking him to Gilcrease Orchard, but it was when we received air quality warning saying it was unsafe for sensitive groups. And when you looked outside, it looked really cloudy, but it was really smoke. And I was like, I am not taking my son out there. He has extreme allergy issues. I'm worried that it will develop into asthma.
Asthma, again. It's come up in every episode. Cynthia and her neighbors find themselves dealing with the same predicaments we've encountered with Michael Johnson in the Bronx and Gina Ramirez in Chicago. The health of communities is suffering on account of things that climate disruption is just going to make worse, and they're forced to fend for themselves.
I live in the area where it's highly Latino. I talk to my neighbors a lot because of the smoke and the bad air quality days that we've had. They have mentioned that they have had sore throats. They've had watery eyes. They're sneezing a lot more. They also have headaches. At first, they were afraid because they thought it was COVID, and started talking to them about the air quality, and they started making that connection. But also, the Latino community is one of the highest hit communities here when it comes to high asthma rates. And we have one of the highest rates of kids missing school because of their asthma attacks. And also because a lot of folks in my community do not have insurance.
Cynthia's found her own ways to counter the effects of dirty air.
I had to buy air purifiers for the home because even though we weren't spending much time outside, I noticed that when the air quality was not good, he would still have effects of his allergies, and also he would have flare-ups on his skin. I don't want to just give him allergy medicine all the time. I try to avoid giving him any sort of medication even if it's for his allergies. If there are other ways that I can help treat his allergies, I do that. And buying the air purifiers were a great investment. I also downloaded the air quality app on my phone. And I also signed up for the Clark County air quality forecast.
According to the National Institutes of Health, effects of wildfires range from direct thermal injuries and death to the exacerbation of acute and chronic respiratory symptoms caused by exposure to wildfire smoke. There's also a financial risk. Researchers found the global economic burden per person affected by wildfires is more than twice that of earthquakes and 48 times higher than that of floods, although the global number of events and number of people affected by floods are much higher than for wildfires. Sam Perkins explains in more detail.
The job for most folks takes a huge toll on the body and the mind. Just looking at the media response from these most recent Labor Day fires, a lot of what I saw was the smoke in Portland and Seattle in the Bay Area, the worst air quality in the United States, if not the world at the time. And for a lot of folks that work in this industry, in this world, that is our life for the summer. We live in those thick areas of smoke, deal with terrible air quality, the headaches, the dehydration that may occur, and perhaps downstream impacts of smoke exposure.
And there's a mental toll, too. The families who lost loved ones and homes, the children forced to evacuate, leaving behind their friends and schools, those who bear witness to the damages, sometimes compared to a war scene, firefighters put into the crosshairs on a daily basis.
With the mental health, I think we're a population that deals with many of the similar social issues that a lot of the U.S. deals with, just at a higher rate. I think the suicide rate amongst wildland firefighters is 30 times the general population of the U.S. And alongside that, the amount of drug and alcohol abuse in the off seasons much higher than the general population. And that it's probably a result of the workplace stresses, the lack of resources available to us, and I guess the huge transitions of fire season versus the winter months.
Sam says some people carry more of the burden than others. For instance, a report by CNN found that the recent fires destroyed apartment buildings, mobile home parks, manufactured housing parks, primarily those in affordable housing units. This list also included a camp for people with special needs, which was completely destroyed.
A lot of the public opinion or the community opinion towards natural hazard, in this case, wildfires, dependent on the vulnerability that they may have. You look at a place like New Orleans, and residents of the French Quarter might have a different perspective on hurricane risk than the folks in the Ninth Ward. And that's dependent on, you know, the consequences they've faced or people that they are close with have faced in the past. And the same goes for wildfire risk. You know, if a landowner is facing the threat of losing their entire crop for a year, or uninsured rangeland, or a bunch of expensive fence or cattle, or even structures that are uninsured, they're going to have a lot more personal connection towards the fires. Whereas somewhere like the fringes of Los Angeles or San Diego, places that are rarely touched by wildfire and the insurance policies are comprehensive, people might not have as close of a connection. And a lot of that comes with the socioeconomic status and cultural vulnerabilities, whatever it may be.
Hope, this time around, comes in the form of some inspiration from Sam. He's young. He's aggressive, and he's dedicated to making a difference. In addition to his work fighting fires out west, Sam also spends time around the world assisting with fire policy and program development in other countries, most recently in Nepal.
In Nepal, especially rural Nepal, there's been a huge use in fire for agricultural purposes, whether that's clearing the land or clearing the understory for planting of grains and rice to commercial tree planting operations. In the past decade or so in Nepal and North India, they've been dealing with fire weather that's contributed to uncontrollable wildfires in the area. So yeah, recently I got in contact with the Nepal Ministry of Forest and Environment to help develop a fire program and setting up a public education program, introducing the incident command system, working in collaboration with the Nepal Army to train firefighters and citizen militias, and creating a set of policies that addressed dealing with fire risk for the years to come.
Sam also offers some thoughts on what we can do on our own to counter the recurrence of these raging fires. Because while policy and funding makes a huge difference, we can also do our part to reduce risk. That includes reconsidering where we build homes, how we landscape the property, paying attention to other actions that we do, and making sure that our community members understand potential hazards.
So I think the science is pretty clear that if we don't change some, if not many, of our forest management habits, we're running the risk of losing a lot more. The data has shown that fires will occur with greater frequency and intensity over the years. More people are going to live in fire-prone areas, and the impacts on the general public, the ecosystems we value, and going to continue to increase if we don't change things. And it's a really tricky position to be in because, you know, we don't really have the resources nor the money to transition from a suppression philosophy, which is fighting fires directly, towards the management. And we need public support. Of course, the biggest issue to deal with is just how do we address a changing climate? How do we convince our policymakers to make a change and take care of the public lands, to take care of the atmosphere and whatever it may be?
One other immediate action you can take? Vote. The time is now. We are seeing in vivid detail why that matters. Thanks for listening to Connect the Dots, a podcast by the Center for Progressive Reform. For more information on this episode and the stories behind it, or to find out more about how you can be involved in combating climate change, come visit our podcast site. You can find it at www.progressivereform.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at CPRblog, all one word, and on Instagram, Progressive Reform, all one word. And of course, subscribe to this podcast and share it with your friends. I'd like to thank our guests today, Vicky Arroyo, Sam Perkins, and Cynthia Moore. You can learn more about them at our website, too. Thanks also to our producer, Courtney Garcia, and our assistant producer, Brian Gum. Our theme music is by Lobo Loco and Blue Dot Sessions. And I'm Rob Virchik. Until next time, be safe and take care of one another.